You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in today. I'd like to welcome everybody to the table. And in particular, we have a special guest to start out the program today. Her name is Dr. Mandy Cohen, and she is an internist. She's senior advisor to the Administrator for Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And I'm sure many of you heard a lot of hoopla about the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. But in particular, there are the new health insurance marketplaces that are now starting to take root. So the question is, what are these health care marketplaces? What do they mean for you? So without further ado, Dr. Cohen, welcome to the table. Hello? Hold on one, Dr. Cohen. I think we have her on right here. Doctor?
Hi, Dr. Newcomb. This is Dr. Cohen. Good to be on with a fellow physician.
Yes. It's like the old Chevy Chase movie. Doctor.
Right, I concur,
exactly. So, hey, there's a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of confusion, a lot of questions regarding this healthcare marketplace. And tell our listening audience what in particular is the healthcare marketplace, when it's being phased in, and what it means to the consumer.
Sure. Well, and first also just thank you for having me and helping to clear up. There is a lot of misinformation out there. So what is coming later this year, particularly starting on October 1st, is a new marketplace, a new place for the uninsured to go and purchase insurance. And what makes that new is that we've never had one place before where you can go in a simplified way and see all of your options. And not only that, get some financial assistance to paying for those options. We know that the reason folks have been uninsured is not because they don't want health insurance. We folks know how important health insurance is to their economic security and for their family and for their health. But they haven't been able to access it for two reasons, the cost, and it's complex. And so what we're trying to do with the marketplace is combat those two things. So make a health insurance marketplace that's online at healthcare.gov that will open on October 1st, as well as give folks lower costs on that health insurance. So that's what's coming October 1st.
Now, let me ask you this, Dr. Cohen. Is this only for uninsured, or say if perhaps you have insurance and you don't want to take the insurance from your employer, per se, could you opt out of your employee option and then go into the marketplace and use that as well?
This marketplace is for people who are currently uninsured or who buy insurance on their own currently. So if you get insurance through your job, you will continue to get that insurance through your job.
Okay, so simply for uninsured people. Okay.
Or if you buy by yourself on your own as now. Yeah.
Okay. Now, are these marketplaces going to be on a state-by-state basis? Because a lot of the research that I've done, it seems as though some states want to opt out, and in that case, the federal government would take over these marketplaces. How is that panning out right now across the country?
Right. So the way the marketplaces run is at the state level, and certain states have made the decision to run their marketplace themselves, states like California, New York, Idaho, Hawaii, other states like that have decided they want to run their own marketplaces. In the states that have decided that they don't want to run their own marketplaces, the federal government will be running the marketplace. But to an uninsured consumer, what they'll see is on October 1st the ability to buy health insurance in a simplified way with costs that they can see right up front and as well as financial discounts on that health insurance.
Okay, and that will be readily transparent, and that'll be operational in all 50 states?
And the District of Columbia, correct.
Oh, that's awesome. Now, talk to us a little bit about the subsidies portion of that, because I think a lot of the individuals in the United States, a lot of our fellow citizens, are not aware of potential subsidies based off of what they earn as income. Elaborate on that.
Sure. The way Obamacare was written is that for folks who have up to 400% of poverty, and I know you all don't have those numbers right at the tip of your tongue, but for a family of four, that's about $94,000 a year. So about a family of four making as much as $94,000 a year could qualify for some amount of a discount off of health insurance. And then this is a discount that they get right away right off the top of their monthly cost. So this isn't something that they have to wait a year for. This is something that when they go to shop that they would be able to apply right away. And now, obviously, on the lower income that you are, the more subsidy will be available, up to 400% of poverty. If you are above 400%, clearly still able to shop in the marketplace, take advantage of the benefits of the increased competition, and we've seen lower rates come out across the country, but no subsidy for those above that threshold. But that's pretty generous, and a lot of benefits out there for folks to take a look at and see what makes sense for their family.
Now, Dr. Cohen, if you're at the lower end of the income spectrum, what kind of subsidies are available? Because it sounds like it's a tiered approach. Obviously, the more money you make, the less subsidies you get. So what is it looking like at the bottom rung there?
Right. So there are two ways that we are expanding insurance coverage to folks come October. One is through these new marketplaces where folks can buy private insurance, but the other is also an expansion of the Medicaid program, which has long been in existence, but we are expanding Medicaid to cover more people. So at the lower income levels, folks will, for those states that opt in, and we can talk about what's happening at the state level there, for most folks at the lower income levels, they'll be able to qualify for Medicaid. For those around 133%, and again, I know no one's walking around with those numbers, so around $23,000 or $24,000 a year and above can qualify for those subsidies, and obviously larger subsidies towards the lower income spectrum, and then up to 400% of poverty.
Okay. Now, as far as these online exchanges, are they going to be cumbersome? How is the consumer going to be able to navigate through them, and what kind of information is going to be available to them so that they can compare apples to apples? Because we both know that if you look at insurance companies and you look at contracts, these contracts are written in sort of medical legalese, and they're very difficult to interpret. How are the consumers going to be able to navigate through that maze and make sure that the coverage that they select, they know they're getting what they're supposed to get, and not finding out somewhere down the road that, hey, I thought I had this coverage, and now the insurance company is saying, no, this is not a covered benefit?
Right. So there are two pieces to that. First, the law put in place that any of the plans that are in the marketplace have to at least cover 10 categories of essential benefits. So none of the plans can be sort of skimpy plans. They have to cover hospitals. They have to cover prevention. They have to cover prescription drugs and other things. So those 10 categories have to be in there. So already we've set a floor for the quality of the health plans. But once you get on healthcare.gov and someone goes through the process of applying, that's the beauty of this, is that they'll be able to compare side by side, apples to apples, of what's in each plan and really understand the cost up front, what they're going to pay every month, and what they're going to get from that, and what special benefits might come with any individual plan, and then make the choice that's right for their family. So it's one about just knowing, coming to the marketplace, that there is a quality control for all the plans to begin with. But once you get there, having a simplified process, because we know that's been a barrier for folks in the past.
Okay, excellent, excellent. So now the website is healthcare.gov, G-O-V, and that's where they can go to access the website and learn more about this. Is that correct?
Correct. So starting October 1st is when the application for the financial assistance, as well as all of the plans, will be online. And I should mention, healthcare.gov is the home for all of the states that the federal government is running. That's about 30 states. So the other 20 or so states will have their own individual websites. But what the important thing to know, because I know this shows across the country.
Okay. Hey, Dr. Cohen, if you don't mind holding on, we got a bunch of people who want to ask you some questions. So just hold on. We'll be right with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman, and you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, welcome back. We're here with Dr. Mandy Cohen. She is with the Center for Medicare and Medicaid, and we're talking about the healthcare marketplaces, the exchanges that are actually coming online live October 1st, 2013. So, Doctor, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Okay, well, listen, you don't mind fielding a few questions, do you, from the listeners?
I'd be happy to.
All right, well, let's go first to Wayne on the line. He's in Granby, Massachusetts, and has a question for Dr. Cohen. So, Wayne, welcome to the table.
Thank you, Doctor and Doctor. My question is, living in Massachusetts and being disabled, I don't have much income. I'm covered under what would be RomneyCare. It's actually a pretty decent plan, if I may say. But I'm interested in moving back to New Jersey. Now, I don't know whether you can answer this. Am I have to move there and then try to go to this marketplace and purchase a plan, or am I going to be able to purchase the plan ahead? Is this going to be an issue? This is kind of scary for me.
All right, good question. What do you think, Doctor?
Thanks, Wayne. And, you know, agree. We learned a lot of lessons from the implementation in Massachusetts. I will say I was practicing medicine up there in Massachusetts in Boston when they implemented RomneyCare and, you know, learned some great lessons from that and have brought it here to implement this law. And I will say, yes, what would happen when you move state to state, there are different insurance plans in each state, so you will need to reapply once you move to New Jersey. But the good news is that there'll be a marketplace in all 50 states for you to take advantage of those same benefits. So in New Jersey, the federal government is running that marketplace, and on October 1st, you're going to see new plans and a new place to buy that on healthcare.gov.
All right. Well, thank you
very much.
Thanks, Wayne.
All right. Thank you, Wayne. Let's go next to Gary on the line. He's in Irvine, California, and he also has a question for the doctor. Gary, welcome.
Welcome. How are you?
Good.
Listen, I'm unemployed. I'm disabled through the military, and I have a house, and I have some money in the bank. I can't get a job, though. I tried to, you know, I don't have 100% disability, so I can still work, but I can't because there's no work out there. I can't even, I used to be a machinist. I am now unable to get a job as a machinist, trying to find work out there in Orange County, California. And like I said, I have some wherewithal, so what happens to people like us?
Gary,
with money in their bank, you know, I mean, we don't meet the, you know,
sure,
the threshold. And if you think, you know, I'm saying it's hard to find a job. I've been looking for 4 years now.
No, we got you, Gary. So Dr. Rosen's going to answer your question. Thank you.
Thanks, Gary, for the question. Well, one thing I would say is with these new marketplaces coming online, the idea is to make sure that your health and your financial future is protected and so that you will have subsidies to help you buy health insurance going forward. But as far as some of the other services in terms of job search and other things, I hope you've connected with the VA, as I hear you're a military veteran, and see what help they might be able to provide. I know my colleagues over at Veterans Affairs are always willing to help.
All right. Sounds good. Well, listen, we got another caller here, Dr. Rosen. We're going to go next to George. He's calling from Arkansas and has some questions with respect to Medicaid and whether or not the states that opt out. So, George, welcome.
I'm calling from Alaska.
Oh, Alaska, okay.
But my question is there. Thanks for taking my call and thanks for answering these questions there, Doctor. But my question is we live up here in Alaska, and it's a very red state. And our governor, which I don't approve of, has just opted out of us getting this. So how are we? I mean, there's a lot of villages up here that are poor and they're, you know, they don't meet that high quality standard. So how are we going to, how is this going to hurt us? And is there anything that people can do that want the health care? And I'll hang up and listen and thank you.
Thank you, George.
Thanks, George, for the question, and thanks for calling in all the way from Alaska. So what I would say is what has become a state decision or the governor and the state legislature's decision is about the Medicaid expansion. The marketplace piece of this is going to go on in every state in the country. So Alaska will have a marketplace come October 1st, so there will be new opportunities to get subsidies or discounts on private insurance. Now, here's the rub. for states like Alaska that are not expanding Medicaid, that means there is going to be a gap, meaning those people who are in the lower income levels below 100% of poverty are going to be left without the ability to take advantage of benefits here. I will point out that we do have a strong safety net and always have of places for folks to go seek care, whether it's community health centers. The Indian Health Service is very strong, in particular in Alaska, as well as other safety net hospitals. So, you know, we, particularly the federal government, and always want to make sure folks have place access care. We know that's not the ideal solution. For us, we want everyone to have coverage, which is why we worked hard to make sure Obamacare was passed and is now the law of the land. But don't feel like there won't be places for folks to get care. Do seek out your community health centers and the Indian Health Service and other places to get care. And continue to share stories with your governor and with your legislator about how important coverage is. And you never know, they can change their mind at any point. It is a very generous amount of federal dollars that would come to the state for Medicaid expansion. So they may take a second look at this when they run the numbers and see it working in other states. So stay tuned. I don't think this is the end of the story.
Excellent. Well, listen, Dr. Cohen, thank you so much for that wealth of information. And the website is healthcare.gov. These exchanges are opening up October 3rd, 2013, and we really appreciate your time on the air today.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye now. All right, well, listen, we'll be back with Lou D'Ambrosio. Lou is a former CEO of Sears Holding as well as Avaya, two Fortune 500 companies, and we'll have a very unique opportunity to speak to someone who sits at the top of Fortune 500 corporations and get his perspective on many things, including education, technology, and healthcare.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman, broadcasting from 1480 KPHX, Phoenix, Arizona. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Show. Tom Hartman Program, mind you. Dr. Mike Newcomb here sitting in today, and we have a very special guest on the line right now. His name is Lou D'Ambrosio. Lou is the former CEO and president of two, not one, but two Fortune 500 companies, most recently Sears Holding and Sears and Kmart, and also previously with Avaya Incorporated. Lou also spent 16 years at IBM and spent several years, I believe, with Worldwide Management Council, spending 2 years in Tokyo. And today, Lou is going to give us an interesting perspective because Lou, being a CEO, is going to give us some perspective on three things in particular: education, technology, and healthcare. And also, as a point of disclosure, Lou and I are childhood friends. We grew up together in South Philly. So without further ado, Lou, welcome to the table.
Thanks, Mike. It's great to connect with you. We've known each other for probably close to 40 years, so it's a delight to be back engaged with you again.
No, no doubt about it. Well, look, first, before we get into talking about some of the topics, education, technology, and healthcare, tell people a little bit about your upbringing, too, because you have, you know, obviously a very accomplished career being the CEO of two Fortune 500 companies, but you didn't start there. You started, like we said, 40 years ago back in South Philly. So give our listening audience a little thumbnail sketch of who Lou D'Ambrosio is.
Sure. Thanks, Mike. Well, I was, as Mike said, I was born and raised in South Philadelphia. And for those who are not familiar with South Philly, it's like many neighborhoods around the country. We lived in row homes. I think our parents spent probably about $10,000 for the home. And, you know, you got home from school and you went outside and you played. And not too many people in the neighborhood went to school. I was fortunate to have parents. While they did not have formal education, my mother did finish high school, my father did not, they certainly understood the value of education. So for my parents, education was everything. So, you know, everything, frankly, became second priority versus making sure that the homework was done, et cetera. Had a great time growing up in that environment. And look, you know, while you were not around many, let's say, professors in that area, you learn a certain street smartness and street savviness and a resiliency that I think has a lasting benefit. Growing up in Philadelphia, you know, Penn State was a great football team. That was the only college I was familiar with, and was fortunate to get a full scholarship there, which I went to, and I had a great time, and I was fortunate to graduate on top of my class. Worked there for a couple of years, went back to Harvard to get my MBA. Spent 16 years at IBM, then went to a company that spun out of AT&T called Avaya, which was a Fortune 500 telecom company. I was fortunate to be the CEO of that company. And then, as Mike said, recently ran another Fortune 500 company in Sears Holdings, which is Lands' End, Kmart, and Sears. And recently I've taken some time off to be with my wife and my family. My wife just went through a very serious medical situation. Happy to report, however, that she's now in complete remission. And to close the kind of brief biography, just a few days ago, I was announced as chairman of a clean technology company called Sensus. So that's where we are, Mike.
There you go. Well, that's a good synopsis, Lou. 40 years in less than 2 minutes. So, but listen, let's talk about the education aspect, though, Lou, because I think that to me is something that is germane to, you know, what's really at the heart of how do we transform America today? How do we compete in the global environment? And really, I think our future is at stake with respect to education. And I know you and I have had some offline conversations about education. You spent several years, as you said, in Tokyo, Japan. So, Lou, let's talk a little bit about education and how important is education in this country to allow people like yourself and like myself to come from, you know, row homes in South Philly to become CEOs of Fortune 500 companies and physicians and whatnot. Talk about the role that education played and what do we need to do in America to sort of capture that essence.
Well, you know, it's interesting. On the one hand, it's straightforward, and on the other hand, education is complex. So, like many things, let's focus on the straightforward piece because I think that's what we all have a role in influencing. You know, it's interesting. You mentioned Asia. I just saw an article. It was, I think it was about a week ago where it spoke about the top ranked education for countries around the world. Mm-hmm. And the United States of America's ranking was very, very poor relative to what it should be. It was, you know, kind of 18, 19, 20 in that type of range. Four of the top five countries were in Asia. China was there, Singapore was there, South Korea was there. And I think that is somewhat instructive about the culture that surrounds education. So I think if you were to kind of decompose it into its core elements, number one, I think the students and the parents have a role. This is not just somebody else's problem, but it's the families and the focus that we put on education and then the students' kind of desire to achieve. But then we also, I think, need to dramatically change the paradigm on how we value teachers. I know you and Tom are fortunate to have millions of people who listen on a daily basis. Every one of them probably has this great teacher that they remember. Part of the reason why they remember them is because how extraordinary they were, but also part of it is because every teacher wasn't extraordinary. So how do we societally bring the type of money we need to bring to education so we could have extraordinary teachers? There was another article, I think it was in Fortune, 2 weeks ago, which spoke about a teacher in South Korea making $4 million. Now, I'm not saying we need to pay all the teachers $4 million,
right. But
it talks to the way society values certain jobs over other jobs. So if we get the parents focused on it at the unit level and then societally help create the right type of training, recognition, compensation for the teachers, surround that, Mike, then with a culture about just how education can really help people just change their whole lot in life, I think that certainly gets us off to a good start.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Lou, let's talk about, too, because, you know, oftentimes we see with the education they're trying to sort of hold the, quote-unquote, teachers accountable, but let me get back to that individual responsibility, too. What do you see? What can we do to help empower, you know, American students with the tool sets, with the skill sets that they need so that they can capitalize on education? Now, look, you went to Harvard. You got your MBA there. You know, I went to New York University, medical school. I mean, when I came out of medical school, Lou, I was like several hundred thousand dollars in debt. And it took me quite some time, even as a physician, to pay off those debts. So maybe you can sort of opine on that aspect of it.
Yeah, no, Mike, look, it's a great point. And the beauty of your point is that there's an answer because the way education is being delivered is changing dramatically. The teacher I mentioned in South Korea, that teacher teaches online. So a student's access to education, the days when you had to pay X number of dollars to always go to these, you know, colleges, good or bad, and wait for some teacher to come in and hope that that teacher gave a good lecture and hope that you were awake enough during the lecture to, you know, pay attention to everything, and that you happened to do well on the test that he happened to think or she happened to think was important. That paradigm is changing completely. We are going through a sweeping shift now as it relates to these social technologies, where we have instant information to everything. I mean, think about kind of what the Khan lectures and the Khan sessions and universities have done to education, even in our country. And what you find, Mike, in those individual accountability is people will learn what they want to learn. And now by having this almost infinite catalog of courses and this delivery system that's right at their fingertips, changing that paradigm of education puts more of the onus, I believe, on the individual, but in a good way, because he or she now gets to learn the types of things that they want to learn, how they want to learn, as opposed to somewhat of a kind of an archaic structure where you have to go to certain classes at certain times and hope that you happen to learn from that specific teacher.
No, and I agree, Lou. I actually, believe it or not, I log on to the Khan Academy on a relatively regular basis. I know there's this other company called Coursera, and you also have a lot of the institutional universities, Stanford, Yale, putting a lot of these courses online. And I love it, Lou, like you said, because you can then sort of hone in on what appeals to you and then get state-of-the-art, world-class lectures and advance yourself. But where do you see this going with respect to accreditation, though, Lou, too? Because that's one of the issues there. You can go on and look at these courses and you can advance your own personal skills, but you're not sort of accredited and you're not getting a degree for that. So what do we need to do to address that?
Well, again, Mike, it's a very good point, because let me give you the kind of the negative of the positive that I described. The negative is that today, approximately 85% of people who go online to start a course do not finish the course.
Correct.
So you actually have this duality of issues. One is, if you learn something, how are you getting credit for it, e.g. the accreditation? But then the second piece is, are you just kind of tempted, seduced to go on with it? And we've seen some, frankly, in my opinion, compromised marketing and enticing people to get on it. Do you then stay on it and complete it? What's happening right now, Mike, as you mentioned Coursera and what many of these kind of top universities around the world are doing, that dialogue is taking place right now where the best institutions in the world, like University Penn and Brown and Princeton, et cetera, whereas they shun kind of thinking about online education, today the dialogue is taking place on how online education becomes an increasingly important part of their curriculum, and importantly, how that curriculum then allows these students who may not have the ability to travel certain distances to get the same type of credit as if they were in the classroom. So it's not a solution yet, but versus, let's say, 24 months ago, at least the dialogue is taking place as we speak.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I would love to see that take root, Lou, because then you're opening up the world of knowledge. I know you and I have spoken in the past about sort of the founding fathers and how that if they wanted to exchange ideas, they had to actually send something on a ship for 3 months, and then Ben Franklin have to wait another 3 months to get the response back. This is a whole new paradigm, and it's very exciting. Listen, Lou, when we get back, one of the other topics I want to touch upon is healthcare. So just hold on right now, and then we'll get back, and we'll sort of dovetail into the healthcare aspect, okay?
Thanks, Mike.
All right, thanks, Otto. All right, listen, you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. We're here with Lou D'Ambrosio, and we'll be back in just a short minute.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Dr. Mike Newcomb, sitting in for Tom Hartman, and you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb here, sitting in with Lou D'Ambrosio. As we said at the outset, Lou is a former CEO and president of two Fortune 500 companies, most recently Sears Holding, as well as Avaya Incorporated. And we just talked a little bit about education, and I want to kind of move on now to healthcare. So, Lou, welcome back to the table.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
Yeah, so, Lou, let's talk about healthcare, because, you know, healthcare obviously is a huge issue in this country. You look at it just from an economic perspective, it's the number one, top on the list as far as GDP is as far as the dollars that we consume in this country. And it is something that obviously we all have personal experiences with. I mean, I know you and I have spoken in the past, and, you know, my two grandmothers, you know, were misdiagnosed with a cancer. I know you had some issues with your dad, and many people say this is the best healthcare system in the world. And look, I think it has components, Lou, of the best healthcare system in the world. But, you know, why don't you, from your own unique perspective, give us your perspective on healthcare in America. Where are we now? Where do we need to go, and how do we get there?
Sure, Mike. Let me frame this in two ways. First, as kind of a corporate executive, and then as an individual. I was listening to your last segment where there was a discussion around marketplaces, and I thought some of the callers just had some just outstanding questions. And in my last role, the company that I ran was one of only three companies in the country to have rolled out marketplaces last year. So
and that was Sears.
It was Sears, and it was 1 year earlier than what was mandated. But our view was, let's get, you know, on the program quickly, and let's do what the right thing to do is. And one of the things I wanted to do, Mike, was just to provide your listeners some comfort that the rollout of these marketplaces for us, I would say, went significantly smoother than I had anticipated, both from an administrative perspective as well as the flexibility and the type of coverage that was offered. So you will see that individuals, based on the individual state, will have a choice between what type of company they want to work with and then what type of service they want to get. So while a lot of it still needs to be worked out, having been in one company where we had already rolled it out, I think your listeners can exhale a bit that at least from some early data, those marketplaces do seem to have the potential to do very well.
Excellent.
From an individual perspective, Mike, I will tell you that I've seen both parts of healthcare. I've seen the challenge and I've seen the brilliance. My father, who was, you know, a blue-collar, hardworking, extraordinary man.
Absolutely. I remember your dad, Marty.
Marty, yeah. He, about 6 years ago, he was complaining of pains in his lower back, and he was being treated for back pains, and they were looking at his hip. And my father was one of these, you know, man amongst men who really never complained, so he knew something was hurting him. Long story short, he was being treated for back pain. All along, he had an abdominal aorta aneurysm, which essentially then blew up and killed him instantly. And that was a shock to our family. Another situation with me, even more personally, although, frankly, it didn't impact me nearly as much because it was my dad, but several years ago, I had taken an antibiotic for a sinus infection and found myself 30 days later, no longer able to walk because the antibiotic began to attack certain cells in my body. So I've seen some of the challenges, and I've seen some of the glory. My wife just went through a recent battle with cancer, and thankfully some wonderful physicians at MD Anderson and the Mayo Clinic and University of Penn did a great job. So when I step back, to your point, Mike, like many things, there are pluses and minuses. I think, though, what we need to do, first of all, as a nation, we need to become more proactive in our own health. Once something happens to you, it is a lot harder to take care of than preventing it from happening to begin with.
Right.
So our diet, our exercise, et cetera. The complement to that is that in your field, Dr. Mike, and I admire people for what you, like you, for what you do, because in my judgment, there is a lost art, a lost science of general medicine. Everyone is a specialist. My father went to a lot of specialists. The problem is nobody looked at the whole body.
Right.
And it's like, you know, you've seen those descriptions of when you look at an elephant from many different ways, everybody sees something different, and sometimes you're looking at the wrong end of it. The problem is people need to look at the whole body.
Absolutely.
So just like at the individual level, we need to have that accountability by being more proactive and taking care of our bodies, because it's too late once it happened to then try to address it. So does medicine have to look at the whole body and the person and general medicine. And I think those two aspects will go a very long way, Michael, in terms of improving the healthcare in our country.
Well, and Lou, I think that's part of what this Affordable Care Act has been about. And I know it's a political football, but putting that aside, I mean, really, if you look sort of underneath the covers, if you will, what the president is trying to do, Lou, is precisely what you talked about, is to basically empower internists, family practice doctors, pediatricians. Because, look, when I went into medicine, Lou, and I decided to go into internal medicine, it was not the most well-paid specialty by any means. I mean, most of the specialists who make the money are procedurally oriented specialists, people who do things, like you said, after the fact. And I never really quite understood that, you know, growing up and going through medical school and, you know, watching sort of the economics of healthcare evolve. But now the tide has turned. Now the president has said, look, we need to stop things before they happen. And look, one of the things that you and I have also spoke about, too, when you look at a lot of the healthcare rankings and the outcomes, just like you talked about education, you know, America doesn't really rank very highly on certain benchmarks and parameters. So I definitely think, you know, we need to put more emphasis on the primary care aspect of it. Listen, Lou, we're coming up on a minute here, so we're going to have to get running here shortly. But maybe you can just give some quick final thoughts on that.
Yeah, so the last point I'll make on healthcare is the one other question, Mike, which maybe, you know, next show we could spend more time on, is what do we do with the aging population in our country? We've all seen the statistics about what percentage of our healthcare goes towards the aging population. How do we handle that in a much more effective fashion?
Yeah, absolutely. How do we allocate the resources? And one of the things I want to talk about next time when we have you on the air, Lou, is how do we embrace technology as well to help implement and usher in a new paradigm and a new era? Listen, Lou, as always, my friend, it's great to hear from you. Keep up the great work you do, and we'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good, Mike. Thank you.
Okay. All right, listen, we'll be back with more at the top of the hour. Stay with us.
Listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb here, and also we have another doctor on the show today, Eric. Lots of doctors today.
Yes, there are.
Yes, we have Dr. Nicole Avina. She is a neuroscientist studying, of all things, food addiction, obesity, and eating disorders. And also, she has an upcoming book called Why Diets Fail. So without further ado, let's welcome Dr. Avina. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for having me on the show.
It's great to have you here. Well, tell us, food, addiction, obesity. Let's open the discussion. It's obviously something here, doctor, in this country that is a plight. It's an epidemic. I mean, we see obesity, and it's rearing its ugly head, and it's causing a lot of, you know, damage downstream, a lot of economic damage, a lot of healthcare damage. So why don't we start on the food addiction part?
Yeah, well, you know, you're right. I mean, obesity is becoming a really big problem for us in so many different ways. And so the idea of looking at novel approaches to figuring out, first of all, what's causing obesity, and then secondly, maybe how we can cure it or prevent it, is really something that I've become interested in. And so this is where the idea of food addiction really came into play. The idea would be that we know that there are brain systems and behaviors that are associated with reinforcement associated with drugs of abuse. And when we eat food, our brains act upon those same systems to reinforce our food intake patterns. And so we have the neural circuitry in place for food to be addictive since we're activating similar brain pathways. And so the research has shown over the past few years that when we look at laboratory animals and even studies with humans, that there are similarities in the brain activation when people are overeating high-fat, high-sugar foods, like what you'd see if someone was addicted to a drug of abuse.
Interesting.
And people will also show similar types of behaviors. And, you know, this is something we've heard about anecdotally for quite a while now. A lot of people out there will talk about how they just can't eat one potato chip and they just can't control their intake of certain types of foods. And more recently, there's been a lot of work that's gone into really trying to study this in an empirical way and see whether or not there is some truth to this sort of lure that some foods could be addictive, and it looks like that there is.
Now, are there particular neurotransmitters or particular chemicals, the dopamine system, and what are we finding, Dr. Avina, as far as with respect to the research?
Yeah, so we've been looking at a lot of different neurochemicals that are associated with drug addiction, and so a few that come up are dopamine, for one, which you mentioned, and another one called the opioids. And so there are two pathways in the brain that are activated by drugs of abuse. And so what scientists have done is to take those neurotransmitter pathways and assess them when animals or humans are overeating palatable foods. And what we find is that the same activation of those brain pathways occurs when the people are overeating high-fat, high-sugar foods as what we see when people are taking mild doses of drugs of abuse. So we see similarities in not only the types of neurotransmitters that are being activated, but also the pattern of activation that occurs in response to both foods and drugs.
So let's talk about that then. So if that's the case, then if there is a molecular basis for at least some types of obesity, then are we now starting to come up with some treatments, i.e., you know, chemical treatments, pharmaceutical treatments for obesity other than just, you know, the medicines that sort of depress your satiety centers? I mean, it sounds like there's a whole different kind of approach from the research that you're doing.
Right, exactly. And so that's the hope. The idea is that we've known for years and we've failed for many years at trying to find a really good appetite suppressant. There's been a lot of money that's gone into research, and pharmaceutical companies have invested lots of money trying to develop the perfect appetite suppressant to cure obesity. And what I think is that that's really not the right approach. I think we shouldn't be trying to necessarily reduce people's appetite. We should be trying to reduce their appetite for the foods that are bad for them, so for those foods that are activating these brain reward systems in a drug-like way. And so the idea would be that if we further this research and really can understand how foods affect brain reward systems and may result in addiction, we can then use that information to better tailor and develop some pharmaceutical interventions or to use strategies non-drug-like that are associated with, you know, some success in mitigating drug abuse. And so some of the programs that have been used to help people reduce their drug intake, if we can adapt them or modify them in some way, that might be useful to approach to treating overeating or obesity.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Well, what about the particular foods that function sort of as these addictive chemicals? Are there particular foods that you've seen in your research that fit that category?
Yeah, we've begun to study a lot of different foods. So we initially started off looking at sugar. Sugar was the one food that had been sort of identified colloquially as being a problematic food for many people. There have been a lot of books written about people's, you know, plight with sugar and how they felt that that was just sugar-rich foods were the one thing that they really couldn't control their intake of. And so we decided to start with sugar, and a lot of the earlier studies that were done were looking at sugar, where we saw that when animals were given sugar to consume, they would drink it in excess, they would develop signs of withdrawal, they would show signs of craving, and then they would show a host of changes in the brain that looked a lot like what you'd see if they were addicted to a drug. Since then, studies have expanded to look at other types of foods, and so we've looked at sugar-fat combinations and other types of foods that, you know, people just tend to eat, you know, variety of different foods that contain various amounts of fats and sugars. Mm-hmm. And so it seems that it's the sugars that are highly palatable that are activating our sweet taste receptors that contain excess amounts of sugars are the ones that seem to be problematic and the ones that are producing these addiction-like changes in both the brain and behavior.
Now, what about the other end of that spectrum then, the artificial sweeteners,
right,
the NutraSweets, the aspartame? I mean, what is your research showing with respect to that?
That's a good question, and a lot of people often ask that. And, you know, what I think is happening is it's the sweet taste that's producing these addiction-like changes in the brain and the behaviors that we're seeing. And so when we consume artificial sweeteners as humans, you know, we're not getting the excess calories that you would get if you were consuming real sugar, but we're still activating those brain reward systems. And so it's still potentially perpetuating the addiction, if you will, but we're not having the ensuing calories that come along with it.
Interesting. So now your book is called Why Diets Fail, and it's an interesting title. But in the book, are there any recommendations or solutions to modify your diet or to try to, you know, fight obesity or food addiction?
Yeah, so the book is really two parts. The first part is giving a synopsis of the science behind sugar addiction and really sort of explains why diets fail. Why diets fail? The reason is because diets are not the way to go. You're not going to lose weight and maintain a healthy body weight if you simply go on a diet, because when you go on a diet, that suggests that you'll at some point go off the diet. And so you really need to make long-term changes in the way that you eat. And a lot of the diets that have failed in the past, we believe, do so because they don't address this issue of food addiction, that people have a hard time getting off of certain types of foods and they feel compelled to overeat certain types of foods. And that's an important point to make when we're trying to consider changes in our food lifestyle habits. And so the book goes over the science behind food addiction in a very, you know, general way. And then the second half of the book presents people with some really useful information in which they can understand where they are sugars in their diet, because a lot of people don't realize that if you try to eat less sugar, it doesn't necessarily mean you're just going to not have dessert. There's sugar in a lot of different foods that we consume, and a lot of foods that we don't even know about contain sugar.
Right.
So it offers people some ideas on where you can identify sugars in your diet and ways in which you can deal with the addiction to sugar, so how you can deal with feelings of withdrawal, feelings of craving, the food cues. Our environment is plagued with lots of different cues that lead us to want to overeat certain types of foods. And so we offer solutions on how you can mitigate those or avoid them or cope with them, and also come up with some alternatives to sugar-rich foods that might also satisfy your craving for food, but in a more healthy way that will hopefully help lose weight.
Excellent, excellent. Hey, and one last quick question, because I know we're coming up on the break here, but when they modify the diets, are these neurochemical pathways being modified as well?
Yes. Yes, changing your diet does seem to have an effect, and we see this in our rat studies. When we change the diet to make it a more healthy diet, we no longer see these changes in the brain.
Awesome, awesome. All right, so the website is www.drnicoleavena.com. Thank you so much, Doctor, for your time on the air.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll be back in a moment. Stick with us.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman, and we'll be opening up the Freedom Line, so get in queue right now. Okay, welcome back, my friends. The Freedom Express chugging along, and the Freedom Lines are open right now at 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466. If you have any questions on any of the topics that we've discussed thus far, feel free to give us a call. There's a lot of other stuff happening that we haven't really touched on yet. We know there's a potential new war brewing in Syria. If you haven't heard, I don't know where you've been, but there's been a neurochemical attack in Syria, which we now believe has been conducted by the Syrian government itself. You know, hundreds and hundreds of people have now been murdered, for all intents and purposes, even including young children as young as 1 month old. So the president right now meeting with top advisors to decide what to do with this situation. It's a very volatile situation, and it's touch and go right now. Many people saying that there needs to be some type of response to this. I mean, this violates international law, international code, and the president now consulting with many of the leaders of the free world, including, you know, well, Russia's kind of ignoring us right now, but he's been talking to Canada and Australia and also to other England, all over the world, people trying to collaborate, the United Nations Security Council, to see what do we do with this. I mean, it's a very difficult situation, because we saw what happened with Iraq, and then when we went into Iraq, we got into a quagmire, and we were there for almost a decade, and obviously the Syrian government is not backing down. Bashar Assad, he's, you know, drawn a line in the sand, and if this has been a purposeful move on his part with respect to these weapons of mass destruction and doing it against his own civilian population, then that obviously is of great concern for the world community and obviously for the national interest, the security interest of the United States. So that's one of the topics that's out there right now. Also, the National Football League, from my understanding, I've been looking at some of the headlines, has just come up with a multi-million dollar settlement with many of the former NFL players who suffered traumatic head injuries and concussions and Alzheimer's disease and all these devastating consequences of the brutality of what we know as national football, okay, the National Football League. It is, if you think about it, I mean, you can wear all the pads you want, you can wear all the helmets you want, but these high-speed, high-force collisions, no matter how you look at it, are definitely causing more and more brain damage, and significant brain damage, not just like a mild concussion where you got sort of, you know, your clock rung and you sort of dust it off and get back up. I mean, they're now showing that there is long-term damage, long-term brain damage to these National Football League players. It's not, and look, it's not only NFL players either, Eric. It's anybody
boxers
who plays football. But I'm just saying, in respect to football, well, boxing, clearly, absolutely, you don't have a helmet and you're getting pounded on the head on top of that. So there's no question about it, and this is a serious, serious issue. And look, back in the day, football players, I know you're not a big football or sports fan, but even you remember the pictures of when they used to wear like just these little leather
caps,
that they said were helmets, and that's how they used to play football back then.
They had no padding.
Yeah, essentially no padding. So that's another topic in the news right now that we can also talk about. Obviously, the healthcare issues that we addressed with Lou D'Ambrosio, the former CEO of Sears and Avaya, and also we had Dr. Cohen on from the Centers of Medicare and Medicaid talking about the healthcare exchanges. And then also recently here, we just had our last guest, Dr. Nicole Avina, talking about food addiction. And the fact of the matter is it's not just necessarily you don't have a strong will, Eric. She was saying that there's an addictive molecular basis of these sugars that they stimulate certain pathways in your brain so that you want more and more and more, just like a drug, like a heroin or a methamphetamine or something.
So you could say the fast food industry is a drug.
Well, and in a certain sense, you could. Yeah. I mean, and look, don't think for a moment that these companies haven't looked into that. I mean, just like nicotine
cigarettes, right.
You know, you look at nicotine and remember early on when it was marketed, it was like the cool thing to do. And they had all these advertising campaigns making it cool, but they hid a lot of the science until ultimately there were whistleblowers and others and obviously scientists who clearly were able to show that nicotine is an addictive substance and it's very deleterious to your health. But I would not be surprised if you have these big fast food corporations.
They're formulating their food.
Formulating their food.
To get you addicted to it.
Right. Absolutely. I would not be surprised one second that something like that could be afoot. So those are some of the topics that we have in the queue right now. Like I said, I'm going to open up the Freedom Lines to you, the listening public, at 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466. So let's see who's been holding the longest. Let's go back to Tony in Henderson, North Carolina. Tony, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Yeah, how you doing today?
Hey, every day's a blessing, Tony.
All right, then. Well, I want to talk about the vision of the Democrat Party to win back the Congress. You know, I think I love to see the Democrat leadership come on your show, come on, you know, C-SPAN, and talk about maybe a contract on job bill. You know, mm-hmm. Show the example why Republicans going on TV talk about shutting down the government. Mm-hmm. The leadership in the House need to be talking about, you know, what would they do if they win the Congress back? Maybe, you know, a real immigration bill. Maybe, you know, a contract on job bill, maybe raising, you know, the minimum wage, stuff like that to show the American people, Nancy Pelosi, Chris Van Horn, and the leadership of the Democrats, not just sitting around waiting for something to happen. They out there showing what is their plan to win back Congress.
Hey, Tony, I think those are excellent points that you just made, and I think, you know, maybe you should call the leadership, because I think you had a good 3-4 point plan there. And look, we just talked yesterday about Dr. Martin Luther King and honoring the March on Washington 50 years ago yesterday. And if you listen to a lot of Dr. King's speeches too, Tony, he spoke a lot about what you're talking about right now, about social justice, economic justice, you know, fair labor standards, livable wages for workers. So here we are 50 years later, still fighting the same fight. But what I think we need to do is, like you said, Tony, we need to let our leadership know, don't be shy about this. Don't sit on the fence. Get out there and speak from the highest mountaintops. Let the people know that this is our agenda. We want, you know, equality. We want good jobs. We are fans of the family unit. But a family unit, a nuclear family, can't be a nuclear family and can't stay strong together if they don't have a livable wage, if they can't afford health care, if they can't send their kids to a good school. So I think all those things that you alluded to, Tony, are spot on. And I give you my commitment. I know a lot of people in Congress and the U.S. Senate and in politics, and I'm going to keep working, you know, as hard as I can to let them know about it. So thanks a lot for your call, Tony.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we'll be back with more of the Tom Hartman program in a moment. Stay with us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Call 866-987-THOM.
The crash of 2016 is coming, and I'll tell you about it when we get back. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman program. Let me elaborate a little bit on that. As you just heard Tom say, he has a new book coming out. It's called The Crash of 2016, The Plot to Destroy America and What We Can Do to Stop It. And just so you, Tom's ardent fans, know, it includes Tom's letter to his grandchildren and what it means. So definitely don't miss this book. You can go over to the website, www.tomhartman.com. That's TOMHARTMANN.com. And you can click on the link and pre-order your copy right now. And I'll tell you, Eric, he's gotten quite some good reviews here about his book from some very, very familiar people. So let me just give you a few people here. You heard of Leonardo DiCaprio, haven't you?
Of course.
Of course. You know, one of my favorite movies, Titanic. But he's done a lot of other good movies as well. But in any case, this is what he had to say, you know, about Tom. He said, Tom Hartman seeks out interesting subjects from such disparate outposts of curiosity that you have to wonder whether or not he uncovered them or they selected him. So that is from Leonardo DiCaprio. Another endorsement here, I'll tell you, if you haven't read this book too, it's another great book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, John Perkins. That was one of my favorite books that I've read in quite some time. They should make a movie out of that book. But here's what John says. John says, Tom Hartman is a literary descendant of Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Paine. His unflinching observations and deep passion inspire us to explore contemporary culture, politics, and economics, challenge us to face the facts of the societies we are creating, and empower us to demand a better world for our children and grandchildren. So that's from John Perkins, author of the New York Times best-selling book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And then let me give you one other one. I mean, it goes on and on, but let me just give you one other. Van Jones. Many people know who Van Jones is. He is the co-founder of RebuildTheDream.com and author of The Green Collar Economy. He says, quote, never one to shy away from the truth, inspiring, wise, and compelling. His work lights the way to a better America. So I would definitely encourage all listeners to check it out. Tom is a phenomenal author. I mean, Eric, we have like
prolific.
We have a library here, don't we? We call it the
A whole shelf full of Tom's books.
The Tom Hartman Library here at the KPHX Studios in Phoenix. I mean, it's just book after book after book. But this one is called The Crash of 2016, The Plot to Destroy America and What We Can Do to Stop It. So definitely check it out, my friends. Now, listen, I know we got a lot of callers on the line right now, and many of you are calling about this whole Syria issue. So what I want to do before I actually jump into that particular topic, I read a little online story the other day about what's happening in Syria, and I'll tell you, it is quite disturbing. Let me just kind of read you some of these highlights here, and this was from NBC News, and then we'll get into the calls at 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466. But it says here, the lifeless faces of 20 children stare out from the wall of a Syrian hospital, where workers are still struggling to identify the youngest of the dead 6 days after a suspected chemical weapons attack killed hundreds. The hospital in East Damascus took in 600 patients after last week's poisoning, and officials there said 110 of them died. 35, more than half of them, were children who have yet to be claimed, okay? According to one of the hospital workers, he said, we still have 20 children, and he pointed to one girl and said, quote, one of her relatives came today and tried to identify her, I get teary-eyed about this, by her necklace that she was wearing, okay? And then he went on to say also that we still have this infant. Her age may be about 1 month old, and we put her as unknown number 14. I mean, if that doesn't cause you to have tears or sadness to me, it's just devastating, devastating. One other thing, the little girl that I just spoke to you about, the 1 month old girl that is known as unknown 14, number 14, she died in the arms of a volunteer paramedic. His name is Abu Ahmed. And they tried to save her life in vain. She was the youngest martyr, he said. And the rest of them have been between 14 years of age and less. Okay? Other footage showed Ahmed cradling the newborn after the attack, a bib still around her neck and her lower body swaddled in a blanket with the word baby. Think about that. Think about what's happening right now over there. Innocent young kids, people dying. One of them, they said, she sniffed and died. They sprayed water on her, but they couldn't do anything. May God have mercy on us, he said. May God have mercy on us. He said, this innocent child that went to sleep and never woke up. So I just wanted to give you that as food for thought before we jump into this conversation. And I don't know what to anticipate. I don't know what you're going to say. I don't know where people feel or what you feel on this particular matter. But I can tell you what I feel. And I don't think we could just turn a blind eye and a deaf ear to this kind of carnage, this type of genocide, this chemical weapons attack on innocent civilians in Syria, regardless of who is responsible, whether it's the Syrian government, whether it's the opposition. To me, it doesn't really, quite frankly, matter. The fact of the matter is it happened, and it can happen again. This is not the first instance either. They said there's about 14 instances so far that they can corroborate that chemical weapons have been used on innocent civilians already in this civil war in Syria. So I don't believe that we are separate and distinct. As I've often told you on this program, we're all human beings. We're all in this together. We're not the independent United States. We're not separate from the world. The world community looks to us as a beacon of hope and of liberty. And when you have oppressive regimes, when you have evil dictators and authoritarian governments out there committing genocide on innocent people, our fellow human beings who are no different than us, they might look different, their skin color might be different, they might speak a different language, but like I said, you cut somebody open and underneath you see a heart and a lung and kidneys, they all look the same. You cannot tell the difference. So we are connected. We are connected as a human race, as a human species. And we can't turn a blind eye and a deaf ear when this kind of carnage, this kind of evil rears its ugly head in our society, in our world community. We have to do something to help. So with that being said, that's my perspective on this. But let's go to the listeners and see what you guys have to say. Let's start out with Laura. She's calling in from Chicago, Illinois. Laura, you're live on the Tom Hartman program.
Yeah, doctor, you're making a leap. There is absolutely no proof that Assad administered that gas on his own people. I have been listening to the MPs in Parliament debate this all day, and none of them had any proof. They're all waiting for 10 Downing Street to show them the proof. There is no proof, so you cannot say it is Assad. It could have been the rebels. They're being armed by Saudi Arabia, by Qatar, by the U.S., by Israel. There's a number of different factions. Stop it. I am begging our media to stop jumping to conclusions when there is no proof. The U.N. weapons inspectors told us today to wait until their inspections are over, till their investigations are over. I am begging our media to do that. You are jumping to conclusions.
Well, Laura, hold on. First of all, I'm not jumping to conclusions because if you heard what I just said, and I, you know, the tape is there. I said I don't care if it was Assad. I don't care if it was the opposition. I said that's what I said. It could be either or. The fact of the matter is that there is a chemical attack on innocent civilians, and that the world community cannot turn a blind eye and a deaf ear on this. That's a fact. We know that. We know that the attack happened, and we know that innocent people perished and died as a consequence. So all I'm saying, Laura, is that we can't just say, oh, it wasn't Assad, so therefore it's okay, and just let it keep happening. We have to figure out, you're right. You know, right now there's circumstantial evidence. Right now it seems to be that the American intelligence community, even Vice President Biden, our own President Barack Obama, seem to have very strong opinions that indeed it was Assad that was behind this. But my point, Laura, is that regardless of who's behind it, one, they shouldn't have possession of these weapons, and two, they shouldn't be using it. So we have to do something. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, and you know what I would do? I would stop arming the rebels. That's number one, okay? And I don't even call them rebels anymore. They're mercenaries. There's so many foreign mercenaries in Syria, it's not even funny. So we should appeal to Qatar and Saudi Arabia and Israel and ourselves to stop giving them weapons. That's number one. Number two, a strike on Syria is only going to kill more innocents. It doesn't matter to a baby if they're blown up or if they're gassed. They're both dead. So a strike on that country is absolutely out of the question at this time. I am firm on this one. And then we have to have a peace process, a diplomacy, mm-hmm. and we have to get all of the factions in and be talking about this. But first, we have to stop arming this. We're just escalating it in Syria by arming the so-called rebels. And many, many reports from Syria say they are not even Syrians.
All right. Well, listen, Laura, I appreciate your perspective, and thank you for calling into the Tom Hartman program. Okay, that's Laura calling in from Chicago, Illinois. We're going to take more calls on this and any other topics at 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466. But look, I'm not so sure that arming the opposition, if we know that they're fighting an evil dictatorship, is not the right thing to do. I mean, we did this over in Libya, and we're able to get rid of Gaddafi and pave the way for diplomacy and democracy. Granted, it's not perhaps moving along the pace that one would expect, but sometimes you have to help out the rebels. So we'll be back with more in a moment.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Check out Tom's latest book, The Crash of 2016, The Plot to Destroy America, and What We Can Do to Stop It at TomHartman.com. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Let's get back to the callers on the Freedom Lines right now. It seems to have lit up the phone lines here, this Syria discussion. So without further ado, let's go first to, let me see here, who's been holding? Let's go to Andrew in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, see what's on Andrew's mind. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good.
About Syria, it happens now that the situation is that the Syrian army is fighting al-Qaeda in Syria. So we all are against the use of chemical weapons, whether it was the regime or it was the rebels, that would be mostly al-Qaeda. We should go after whoever sent the order to use chemical weapons, because this is an atrocity. Now, we still cannot find out. Our administration is saying that they have some evidence. We know they could manufacture evidences or whatever they could do. There is always a way to do it. And if you remember, there was a manufactured, fabricated evidence that Saddam Hussein's officials met with al-Qaeda somewhere in Europe, which turned out to be just not true.
Sure, sure. No, look, I agree with you, Andrew, in the sense that we know what that whole weapons of mass destruction scenario was a fabrication on behalf of the Bush administration, and we ultimately went to war for that. But this is not a fabrication. We know for a fact that chemical weapons were used, and it's likely the sarin gas that was used, and that, you know, hundreds of people are now dead, innocent children are dead, and thousands upon thousands of people were affected by that. So we know that this is not a fabrication. The question is, who is responsible? Is it Bashar al-Assad and the government, or is it the opposition forces, al-Qaeda? We don't know. But clearly, you know, we can't live in a world or society where people have access to those types of weapons and are using it on innocent civilians. Would you agree with that?
Appreciate that. Now, if we now bomb the Syrian army, now they happen to be protecting Assad, who we don't like, and so forth. If we kill one soldier, or if we destroy whatever piece of army that the army of Syria has, this is one soldier less fighting al-Qaeda. For these people who are now promoting the war, and they want to tell us that they are working for our interests. If they want to work for al-Qaeda, they have no place being in Washington or at the Pentagon. They can go and work for al-Qaeda. They are working for us, the American people, and their interest should be to protect us. If we bomb Syria, we're going to have more people radicalized in the Middle East against us, the American people.
Yeah,
the
no, and it's very
making the decision are going to be walking all over America with protection. We, the American people, have no protection. When we get on an airplane, we don't have a private jet to travel. All right, so we...
No. Look, Andrew, I agree with you. I agree that you have some really good points. Let me do this, though. Let me get some other people's perspective here. Andrew, I totally appreciate what you're saying, but I definitely want to get other people on the line who might have some complementary perspectives or maybe even different perspectives. So let's go next to Dwayne on the line from Queens, New York. Dwayne, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
How you doing, Dr. Mike? Long-time fan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First of all, I like to, I'm totally in disagreement with your previous caller, the lady from Chicago.
Right, Laura.
I totally disagree with what she had to say. Over 100,000 people have been killed in this conflict so far to date. We originally set a red line in the sand about the chemical weapons. They were used in a smaller instance. We did nothing. Now they're used in a larger instance. And we're attempting to do something, but we haven't done anything yet.
Correct.
My fear is that if we don't do anything, first of all, it emboldens the Kim Jong-uns and, the Iranian leadership. It emboldens them, and it gives Assad the okay to use much more dangerous weapons like anthrax or smallpox or something like that.
I think someone
had mentioned that the other day, and I just think that by not responding, we're making the world much more dangerous.
And then, like you said too, Dwayne, to your earlier point is that over 100,000 people have already perished in the civil war. So this is not just a few hundred people killed from a chemical attack. We're talking about over 100,000. It's a very unstable region. And look, I do believe ultimately that the world community needs to start acting like a world community. And when we see evil dictatorships, when we see death and destruction, when we see innocent civilians being killed, when we see chemical attacks, we just can't continue to turn a blind eye and a deaf ear. I mean, didn't we learn from Hitler? Didn't we learn that when you let evil just fester and continue to grow, that ultimately it'll keep doing that until somebody steps in and says enough is enough? So that, look, we got to get more to a world community where when we see these things, we need to stomp on it immediately and smite it and make sure that it doesn't grow and stop saying it's not my problem, it's someone else's problem. As far as I'm concerned, that's my fellow human being, man. That's a human being that, that they're being tortured and killed and I don't know. Just my gut tells me you just can't turn a blind eye and a deaf ear to that stuff.
They're getting scuds fired at them. They're getting, villages are getting totally destroyed. I mean, at what point is enough enough? I mean, we're the superpower.
Right. Would we have to wait to 500,000 people die, to a million people die? Do we have to wait for a Holocaust, 6 million people die? I mean, I'm sick and tired of evil and dictators and authoritarians in this world. And, we the good people, the loving, the compassionate people in the world, we got to start standing up for the innocent people who have no recourse but to be subjugated and suppressed and oppressed. We need to find something to do to help them. And I'm not saying, Dwayne, that we go in there and we bomb the society. I'm not going in there and saying, we drop a nuclear weapon or a chemical weapon ourselves. All I'm just saying is that we can't just say it's their problem, it's not my problem, and just let them do what they want to do because they're their own country and their own government. That I don't agree to that philosophy. So listen, I got to run. I got another caller. So thanks a lot, Dwayne, for calling in from Queens.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. All right, listen, we still got a whole slew of callers here on the line right now. I know a lot of people want to weigh in with their thoughts on this particular topic, and we're going to do our best to get everybody in the queue, okay? So I believe we're going to the top of the hour right now. But as I said, when we get back, we still got Sanchez on the line from Long Beach, California. We got Larry on the line from Victoria, British Columbia. We got Donald on the line from Aurora, Illinois. Greg from Watsonville, California. I mean, it goes on and on and on. Tom's got a national audience, an international audience there with British Columbia. So we'll be back at the top of the hour and taking your calls.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman program. We're going to continue on with the Freedom Lines right now. The Freedom Lines are packed at 1-866-987-8466, 1-866-987-THOM. Let's see, how do we want to handle this, Eric? Let's go to, I don't know, let's, Oh, it's tough here. All right, let's go to
the next in line.
Let's go to his next in line because I want to try to keep the thread going about Syria, but you know, we can mix it up. Who cares? All right, let's go to Michael on the line from Imperial Beach, California. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hey, Dr. Newcomb, how you doing?
I'm doing well. What's happening, like Michael?
Not much. I'd like to ask you a question that I asked Tom a long time ago. Now, you as a doctor know the difference between men and women. Given the way that men treat women, especially in the Middle East, if women were in control of this planet, do you believe we'd have aircraft carriers? Now, women share childbirth. Men share nothing. Men want to take your wife. They want to take your property. So, again, what do you think the world would look like if women were in control of this planet from day one?
Well, it's an interesting question here, and I have to say, because I come from a family of very strong women, and look, I don't want to obviously overgeneralize, but I do think there are certain attributes in women that are distinctly different than men, okay? And look, like you mentioned, women have the reproductive capabilities to give birth to children, and I just think it's hardwired into a woman's DNA that they are by nature nurturing. They're nurturing people, and they... You know, that's just part of who women are. They're givers. They tend to the needs of the innocent child. You know, they guide that child through the early years. It's a very selfless act. It's not a selfish act. It's a selfless act. And I think, you know, in that perspective, you know, I look at my mother, I look at my aunts, I look at, you know, my friends who are women, people who have had babies, and I think by nature, yeah, they are more nurturing. I mean, men generally tend to be, and I'll have to say, I mean, I see my fellow man, and sometimes I'm disgusted, to be honest with you. I mean, they are, you know, this virility and this machismo and this fact that because I'm stronger and bigger that, you know, I'm going to impose my, you know, will upon you. And then, you know, and it's all part of the old culture, though, if you really look at it, Michael. If you look at, you know, you go back, well, it's not even old because it's still prevalent, you know, to this day. I was looking at a story online where one of these judges was talking about how his wife needs to be subordinate to him and that she needs to kind of, you know, be below him and let him sort of be the quote-unquote man. And, you know, men have been like that throughout the ages. I mean, if you look at it, man has persecuted women, man has subjugated women, man has, you know, look, even in this country, you know, we talk about African Americans and their subjugation. A woman couldn't vote until what, 1919 or 1929, it's roughly around there, in the early 1900s, you know, women couldn't even vote. So, yeah, I would agree with you that to a certain extent, you know, if you were to generalize that women are more caring, more nurturing, and more loving and more compassionate in general than men. That's not to be confused with the fact that there are not men out there who are who possess those similar attributes or those similar qualities. But yeah, I would agree with that. So,
thank you.
Okay, all right, there you have it. That's Michael calling in over there, and let's opening up another Freedom Line. So let's go back next to Donald. Donald's calling in from Aurora, Illinois. A lot of people who are interested in this Syria topic seem to be from Illinois. So interesting demographic there. Hey, Donald, welcome to the program.
Hi, Doc. How you doing?
Good.
You know, I'm a veteran, and I'm so fed up with this thing. I was surprised that President Obama even put his foot in the sand there by drawing this line. But the thing is, I think... By the way, the press approached him. I think he was taken off guard by that, and he thought he said what he had to say. But you know what really kills me is John Kerry, another one that I was going to vote for, that I voted for, that I was hoping to he'd win the election as the president, because he, when we were all getting out of the service, I remember there was a lot of us against the Vietnam War.
Sure.
He was one of them, and he spoke so good about how wrong that war was.
Sure.
And he was right. Years later, I was having to watch TV, and I see Robert McNamara, one of his last interviews. He literally came down and admitted the truth, that the Vietnam War was wrong, and we didn't have to be there. Well, 58,000 of my fellow veterans are sitting on a wall there. All that's left of them is their names. And now, all of a sudden, it was the wrong thing to do.
Right.
Isn't that funny? Lose a conflict, gain a conscience. And it seems to happen all the time with this country.
Let me ask you this, Donald, because, you know, I really do truly appreciate your perspective on this. And in which division, which part of the military were you part of?
I was in the Army.
In the Army.
And the thing is, I was in the Army. Not only that, there's one other thing, too, I want to point out.
Yeah.
This business, it happens all the time. They start throwing the women and the children in our face with this so-called moral obligation and to make us feel guilty. Well, where is the moral obligation and the guilt when they send our soldiers into wars that they shouldn't have been in? These two wars are illegal that they've
right.
been in.
Now, you bring up excellent points, Donald. That's why I'm going to try to kind of tease out this with you a little bit more. So let me ask you this. As a veteran, as somebody who served, you know, our country, and thank you for your service in the Army, what role should the military play in America when we do see genocide, or we do see innocent civilians being victims of chemical attacks? I mean, are we to say, and I don't know the answer, I'm just asking you this, is it better for us to just to be isolationists and say, look, it doesn't threaten our national security, it's not us, they got to deal with it? Or do we have, like you had mentioned earlier, a moral obligation to say that, wait, these are fellow brothers and sisters, even though they're not countrymen, they're still fellow human beings, and do we have a moral obligation to at least help? So I'm curious on your perspective on that as a veteran and a former Army officer.
Well, I wasn't an officer. I was just a Spec 4. But the thing is nevertheless, I'm against war completely. And the thing is, this here is nothing but a civil war we should not be getting into. It's just going to escalate. The business of thinking that they're only going to drop a few bombs in there is going to change things. It won't. It might Sure. even escalate things. And that's what I'm afraid of. The consequences that we're going to have to pay. Now, you have a few callers that are calling up or saying, oh, yeah, go ahead, we should get involved. These people, they have no stake in the game whatsoever. They're like Mitt Romney. Go ahead and fight that war. He was fine with us going into battle, but he took off to France. And this right. is what these people expect us to do. And, you know, I don't want to see any more fellow soldiers getting killed. For God's sakes, 4,000 of our GIs have gotten killed over the last 10 years. If we go into battle this time, you won't see 4,000 in 10 years. You're going to see 4,000 in one battle, like the likes of the World War II. We can't have that. And I'm sick and tired of hearing these generals that are coming up on progressive radio and a lot of these Democratic politicians like Sherrod Brown. Oh, he's another one. And there was a couple of other ones. One was a Hispanic. Oh, yeah, the president's doing it. No, he's not. And I love our president. Don't get me wrong. I voted for him
right.
twice.
But on this particular issue, you think we don't belong in Syria, and your point is well taken. All right, listen, Donald, let me get the other calls. Thank you for calling in, though.
Sure.
All right, there you have it, Donald. There, Army veteran, weighing in with his particular thoughts. All right, let's open up the Freedom Lines to more people, see what they have to say. Let's go next to Donna on the line from Columbia, California. Donna, welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say that the hypocrisy and the self-righteous jawboning is just gibberish. We, us, as Americans, our government has used white phosphorus, depleted uranium, Agent
right.
Orange, atom bombs, torture, kill lists, drones, and we support dictators all the time, sometimes known as monarchies, in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia.
Right.
We gave up any moral standing a long time ago, and to thump our chests and self-righteousness is just not
right. The pot calling the kettle black, is that it?
Right.
Yeah. No, well, look, you bring up a valid point, too. It's not like we are without blame, or that we have not conducted such type of things, you know, in the name of on behalf of our own government. So point well taken. All right, listen, Donna, I got to run. It's a break, but thank you for calling in from Columbia, California.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, listen, I know we still got a whole bunch of callers and listeners in here and want to have their voices heard, so just stick with us. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, and don't forget to get Tom's book. Go to his website and check it out. Okay, welcome back. We have another special guest on the line, and then after that, we'll get back to the Freedom Lines. So if you're on hold right now, just stay there. We'll get to you after the next segment. To the bottom of the hour, but we'll have Michael Cohen on right now. Never mind. We don't have Michael. I thought Michael was here right now. So, okay. In any case, that means we can go to the Freedom Lines, Eric.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, indeed. So let's just get back then, because a lot of people are really jazzed up about this whole Syria issue.
Yeah, I am.
What do you think? I mean, do we just...
I say stay out of it.
Stay out of it?
The last caller, I agree with him 100%.
So just stay out of it, let them kind of do what they need to do, and
I mean,
let the dust settle
this,
whatever
this is
may.
How it always starts, you know? Next thing you know, we'll be there for 10 years, like you said.
I know, but I just wish the world community... Like, imagine if we were all together. Like, if we had every nation
just stop
together...
killing each other.
And soon as this happens, you know, I just wish there was, like, a world police. Like, a world supranational... sort of military that anytime evil reared its ugly head and you get people like Saddam Hussein.
Isn't that what the UN is?
Well, no, it's not, because the UN is actually paralyzed by the way that it's structured, because the UN, you have permanent voting members of the Security Council, and there's like, I think, what, five of them? Roughly five or six. Anyway, I don't know the exact number, but I think it's five. But the point is, United States, Russia, I think it's Britain, France, and I don't know if it's Germany or China. But anyway, China, I don't think so. But the point is that those permanent members have veto capability. So in other words, right now, if the United Nations Security Council of the five countries that are permanent voting members said, hey, you know, four of the five said, let's do it, or three of the five said, let's go and do it, it doesn't matter, because either of them alone has a veto power. And right now, Russia, being one of the Permanent Security Council members, is obviously saying no. And now they're sort of posturing and sending some of their warships close to the waters in Syria, as the United States sends our warships to perhaps do some missile strikes, strategic missile strikes. So you see, it's escalating. And so even though it's
already
supposed to be the United Nations working together to smite out evil, the politics comes into play, and they really don't effectively function as a supranational sort of world security force to smite evil, and it just doesn't work like that, unfortunately. I dream of a day that hopefully will, but it doesn't. Okay, well, listen, let's get back to some of the callers right now. Let's go to Jason on the line in Arlington, Virginia, has a comment on Syria. Jason, welcome.
Hey, I can't strongly disagree with you even more. The idea that you want to put us under some type of one world government type of policing only is going to water down everything that's going on here. We'll have no sovereignty, and we're going to start taking dictation from people like the United Nations. That's crazy. Now let me kind of run through what's going on with Syria here, because everyone is getting it wrong. Okay, first, the people who are financing the mercenaries in Syria is being done by the government of Qatar. They have spent $2 billion. Remember, follow the money. Qatar wants to build a natural gas pipeline to supply Western Europe with energy. Currently, 75% of the energy to Western Europe is being supplied by the Soviet Union. In 1989, Russia's economy collapsed because the price of oil dropped from an inflation-adjusted $80 down to $20. If we allow a pipeline to go through, the Russians are facing the idea that they will have their economy collapse.
Mm-hmm.
The people that we're trying to support, again, France and England are on board with this because they want the cheaper natural gas prices, and they don't like the idea that the Soviet Union can turn off their gas in the middle of the winter. Okay, Assad using gas, though, from a military perspective, knowing that the inspectors are coming in a week or so to use gas, you can go to the Naval War College, the Marine College, any Armed Force Services College and ask them, does this make strategic sense to use this if using gas would ensure that the United States would become involved? It would be the stupidest military blunder in history for this to take place. Unless, of course, you want to convince a bunch of people by showing a bunch of dead bodies of babies and children, just like the Iraqi girl that was talking about the babies in the incubator who turned out to be the Kuwaiti ambassador's daughter, to try to win the hearts and minds, because remember, that's what we always do in war, right? Win the hearts and minds of people, not using logic, to convince us to go into this thing. And the thing that's getting to me right now is the fact that all of the people that were against the tragedy that took place in Iraq are suddenly now becoming apologists, because if you're upset about this, then you have to be 100% in favor of all the military action that we did in Iraq, because the scale of death over there was much greater.
Yeah, no, Jason, you bring up some excellent points, and I don't dispute the fact that, look, this, it's a war game going on, and like you said, it's like a game of chess. That's there's so much politics involved, economics involved, you know, selfish interests involved. It's, you know, very difficult to discern, you know, who actually conducted this attack. You know, was it, you know, Assad, like you said, and it was a blatantly stupid strategic move on his part? Was it the opposition trying to frame him and make it look like it was him? Look, I understand all of that, but I guess my point is, and maybe this is the doctor coming out of me. I mean, my job, Jason, is to heal people, to make people well, to alleviate suffering, to alleviate pain, to have compassion. That's what I do for my living. That's what I have done throughout my life. So when I see this and I see human beings being so stupid and doing things like chemical weapons and killing innocent people, it does tug at my heart, and it gets me angry. It gets me very angry that whoever's doing it, whether it's the opposition or whether it's Assad, that they think that they can get away with it and that they can actually, you know, like you said, play these war games on the international stage and put propaganda up there and put the pictures of these innocent lives so that, you know, they know that it'll evoke emotions in certain people and then cause us to act on it. That's what really bothers me, Jason. And those kind of people, like I said, I would love to see them smitten from this earth. And I don't think it's going to happen if just the United States can't do it singularly. You know, another country can't do it singularly. When I talked about a supranational military, I wasn't necessarily talking about one world government, but just some type of security force where people of like mind who don't like evil can, when they see it, smite it. That's kind of what I was saying. So, anyway, listen, I appreciate the call. Good points. Listen, when we get back here, we will continue with the Freedom Lines. I do believe we have a guest at the bottom of the hour, so we'll be getting to that guest. And look, a lot of people still holding on from Tennessee, Connecticut, New York, California, Wisconsin, Colorado, British Columbia, Oregon. I tell you, man, what an audience he has, Eric.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Don't forget to go to TomHartman.com and check out The Crash of 2016, The Plot to Destroy America, and What We Can Do to Stop It by Tom Hartman. Okay, we got another guest on the line right now. Michael Cohen is his name. He is a fellow with the Century Foundation, also U.S. political columnist with The Guardian, London Observer, and also author live from the campaign trail. What we're going to be talking about today is the Republican Party's quote-unquote defund Obamacare disorder. And as a physician, I have to tell you, I do believe it's beginning to become a disorder. So, Michael, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah, so what's up with this, Michael? I mean, they just will not relent. I mean, it was passed into law. It was approved by the Supreme Court. They've tried to defund this how many times now in Congress?
They voted 40 times to repeal it.
40 times. So is it the new adage, if first you don't succeed, try 40 times again?
Try 39 more times until you still continue not to succeed.
Right.
It appears to be it's really amazing. Like, it's like the way I sort of deal with my daughter, who's 20 months old. I mean, they just cannot sort of take a hint on this one, and they keep pushing the issue over and over again. And I think it's become an issue of a fixation, and a dangerous fixation on the right, to the point where when they're not able to stop Obamacare, and they won't be able to, I think the reaction inside the party is going to be volcanic, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost taking the Nancy Reagan's Just Say No campaign to the ultimate extreme.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, well, tell us, what are the threats here, Michael? What are they trying to accomplish? They know that you have pretty much a Democratic Senate. You have a president who is the signatory on the bill, who's not going to, you know, accept that and will veto anything even if it did pass. So what's the whole point of this? Do they really think that they're going to gain traction and put them in a favorable position for the upcoming 2014-2016 elections? I mean, what's the mindset here?
I think there's two things going on here. I think on the one hand, you have a lot of prominent Republicans, Mitch McConnell in particular, who think that Obamacare is a liability for Democrats, and that if they can harm the execution implementation of legislation, that will boomerang against Democrats and give them a benefit in 2014. So I think that's a big part of what's happening here. I'm not sure they're right, but that certainly seems to be the mindset. The problem that they have, however, is that they have spent the last four or so years demonizing Obamacare as though it is the worst thing to ever happen to America. And as a result, they have this, you know, very far right fringe of the party. You know, I shouldn't say fringe; it's increasingly the majority of the party who basically wants to do anything to stop Obamacare. And they've adopted this strategy of saying, well, we're not going to pass a debt limit unless the president agrees to defund or delay Obamacare, which isn't going to happen. And Republicans don't want to let the debt limit, they want to extend the debt limit. They know they have to. And so they're not really going to play that kind of hostage taking. So you have this kind of weird situation where on the one hand it's a political benefit, but on the other hand, they're playing a dangerous game. They have these far-right folks who basically are not going to accept anything but the destruction of Obamacare. And when it doesn't happen, and it won't happen, I think they're going to have some very upset Tea Partiers, some very upset conservatives on the far right who are going to be demanding blood from the Republicans who basically will agree to go along with a debt limit extension or a budget resolution that will continue to fund Obamacare.
Now, it's kind of interesting because I'm a physician in internal medicine. I deal with the geriatric population, Michael. And from my perspective, I have to tell you, I think it's a phenomenal piece of legislation. I mean, it's been long overdue. I mean, I can see its effects already from 2012 onward. And a lot of the major provisions are just now being phased in. I mean, the healthcare exchange market for the uninsured is going to be implemented on October 1st, 2013.
Right.
And then other provisions will be rolled out in the ensuing year. And I just think it is a great piece of legislation. And from what I've seen, that more and more that people become aware of what it really is. And like you said, they're trying to demonize it. And I find it kind of ironic that it's called Obamacare. Only far-right fringe people would try to demonize something with the word care in it. I mean, I just don't understand that. But
well,
in any
– Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No. So my point is, have you seen the same thing that as this rolls out more and more and more, people are saying, wait a second, this Obamacare thing is not so bad?
I mean, you know, it's funny for me. I have a personal self-interest in this issue because I live in New York, which has some of the most expensive individual health care plans in America. I buy my own insurance. And under Obamacare, I'm going to save about $300 a month on my health care plan. That's a big deal for me. It's a big deal for lots of folks who are going to save. I mean, people save even more money. So I think from that perspective, you're already seeing some of the benefits of this. I think people don't understand what the bill means for them. And part of it is because Republicans have, as you said, demonized it, but also have tried so hard to undercut the law. You had this case a few months ago where the NFL agreed to work with the administration on help people understand the bill, you know, helping sort of do PSAs on the bill. And Republicans basically threatened them. Mitch McConnell wrote a letter saying, you know, you could put your antitrust exemption at risk if you went along with this, and the NFL ended up retreating. You have a situation, I think, where people understand the bill, as you said. I think they're going to like it a lot because it's going to actually save them money and ensure that they have health care if they lose their job or if they have to buy the individual market or whatever it may be. So I think Republicans' expectation that there's a big political downside to this is probably wrong. And I think you're right. I agree with your initial comment that in the end, I think this is a very positive thing for the country. You know, obviously, you have 30 million Americans who will now have health insurance. That's a good thing. I think the position Republicans have taken, which is really, I mean, their position is sort of basically is wrong. It's not true. They're arguing that it's going to destroy the private insurance system. That's going to raise premiums. I think there's a lot of evidence that that's just not going to happen. But, you know, that's sort of their argument. And I think in a way they run the risk of being seen as a little boy who cried wolf. They're going to say all these terrible things are going to happen. And when they don't happen, people feel positive things out of it. They're going to even more question Republicans' sanity on this issue.
Yeah, I mean,
but,
the boy who cried.
That is actually that's a further in the future issue for the GOP. The bigger problem is what they're going to do in the next few months when they can't stop this train. And what happens when the Ted Cruzes and the Tea Parties of the world, you know, start attacking John Boehner and Mitch McConnell for letting this happen?
Yeah, I mean, you brought up an interesting analogy with the boy who cried wolf, but I mean, I'm beginning to look at this more as like the whiny, bratty, little, like spiteful little kid who just, if they don't get their way, they're just going to try to make it really, really bad for everybody else. I mean, at least the boy who cried wolf, you know, kind of had maybe a reasonable fear that something was going to happen bad. But this, they're the opposite. This is like, you know, if I don't get my way, and I think you had referenced this in one of your articles, that they're going to do really bad things to the country to the point of, and you can elaborate on this, either shutting down the government or even worse, you know, not compromising on the debt ceiling limit.
Yeah, that's the really serious issue here. I mean, this debt limit issue is a big deal because, you know, their basic position is we're not going to extend the debt limit. We're going to run the risk of a credit default, which would really kind of blow up the U.S. economy if it were to happen. We're going to extend the debt limit only if the Obama administration, the president, agrees to delay Obamacare. That's not going to happen. Obama will never do it. And he won't need to do it because Republicans are going to eventually fold, as they always have on this issue, because they know that politically it's a loser for them.
Right. Well, maybe they can go back and say that as part of the leverage, if Obama's willing to disallow women the right to vote and take away the vote of African Americans, because then that way at least they'll have some leverage in the future elections, and maybe that's the compromise they might want to offer.
I mean, at this point, the president has said he's not negotiating over the debt limit. He negotiated on it 2 years ago. It was a huge mistake. I think he knows it was a huge mistake. We are paying the price for it now with the sequestration, and he won't do it again. And the thing is, again, Republicans don't want to let the debt limit don't want there to be a credit default. They don't want this to happen because they know they'll be blamed politically for it. So they have no leverage on this issue. They're going to have to fold. The problem, as I see it, is that they're sort of, you know, their jihad wing of the party doesn't understand that. And they think that this is a strategy that will work, and they will be angered over the fact that Republicans will have to go along with extending the debt limit and not, in the process, defunding or delaying Obamacare.
Do you ever see
– create a civil war, I think, within the Republican Party.
Let me ask you this, Michael, and we're coming up on the break here, but do you see, honestly, any time in the near future that the Republican Party is going to coalesce around this issue and say, look, enough's enough. You know, like we alluded to earlier, we said it was passed into law by Congress. Supreme Court said it's constitutional. You tried to, you know, overturn it 40 times. Enough's enough. I mean, at what point do they stop this, or are they going to continue this until Obama completes his full term?
Well, here's the thing. After January 1st, they kind of lose the chance to stop this. And that's part of why this debt limit thing is such a big deal, because this is their, as they see it, their last chance to stop Obamacare. And when they fail, that's what will create all these problems. At some point after January 1st, when the bill goes fully into effect, they're going to have to sort of accept reality. There are a lot of folks, I think, who will continue to be angry about this, will continue to blame, you know, Republicans who did not fight, did not sort of die on the barricades for this issue.
Right.
And I don't know how they sort of get their way around it, because you really have this wing of the party that you cannot you know, talk to about this. They basically hate Obamacare. They want to disappear. They don't want to compromise, and they won't accept any compromise that involves Obamacare remaining in effect.
No doubt about it. Well, listen, Michael, thank you for your time on the air. And the article is entitled The Republicans' Party Defund Obamacare Disorder, and that people can check that out on alternet.org, correct?
Yes, or on the Guardian website.
On the Guardian Weather. All right. Thanks a lot, Michael. Thank you for your time today.
Thanks.
Bye. Okay. Well, listen, the Freedom Express is pulling up to its final stop, its final destination for the day, my friends. And we still got a bunch of people online. And the Freedom Lines remain open right now at 1-866-987-8466. So when we get back on the rebound, we'll be getting right directly to your calls.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The crash of 2016, the plot to destroy America, and what we can do to stop it, by Tom Hartman. Check it out on TomHartman.com. Hey, welcome back, my friends, and we're going to conclude today's program by going to the Freedom Lines right now. We're going to finish up this topic with Syria. And let me be clear, because I think, Eric, I've tried to make myself clear, but I think looking at some of the message boards and the Facebook comments, people feel as though I'm agitating for war. I'm not agitating for war by any means. No, I've not said that. What I'm just saying is, no, what I'm asking the audience and the listeners from their perspective is that when you see evil in the world, when you see oppression in the world, when you see our fellow brothers and sisters, fellow human beings being gassed to death, okay, we saw it with Nazi Germany. People were put in ovens and gassed and killed. I would think that the progressive community would be offended by that. I think that the progressive community would find such behavior absolutely unacceptable. And the question that I'm asking the progressive community today is, well, what do you do? Dr. Newcomb has not said, go in there and bomb the hell out of Syria. Dr. Newcomb's not said, go in and put troops on the ground. Dr. Newcomb has not said, go in there and drop a nuclear weapon. That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm hearing everybody say is that it's their problem, it's not our problem. And I don't think that's consistent with the progressive viewpoint. We want peace. We want people to get along. The question is, how do we get there? Do we allow whoever it is, whether it's the opposition, whether it's Bashar al-Assad, whether it's al-Qaeda, do we now believe that we live in a world community where people can get away with that stuff and just do it willy-nilly and that we're supposed to just sit back and ignore it? And I'm not saying use force, but we have to address the issue from my perspective. You just don't ignore it. That's not the moral thing to do. That's not the humane thing to do. It's not the ethical or compassionate thing to do. I'm not agitating for a war. For those of you out there saying, though, sounds like a right-wing show, or we're trying to go out there and, you know, agitate for war and we're hawks. No, on the contrary, I'm a dove. I believe in peace. I don't believe in war. But I don't believe that evil people should get away killing innocent people, whether it be women, children, or men. And that there has to be a solution, that we in the progressive community have to have some type of stance on this. And all I've heard so far is just don't go to Syria. Don't get involved. It's not our problem. And that just doesn't seem to me to be consistent with how we as progressives view the world. So that being said, let me just open up the comments here and hear what other people have to say. Let's go to DJ on the line. DJ, welcome. Hello.
Yeah, hi, doctor. How are you doing?
Good.
I've been in Syria, and I was born in Iraq. And when normally you use chemical weapon, you use chemical weapon when you are desperate. There are 16 provinces in Syria, and they are still under control Bashar Assad. So he is no way in a desperate situation to do chemical for a small village. He has the upper hand in Syria so far. And the war in Syria, from what I know from my contact with people, there's only 30% supporting, only 15% supporting Bashar, and only 15% supporting the opposition. 70% of the Syrian people, they don't want to do anything with either party. Okay? So, that's, and as far as the delay, the okay delay from the Syrian government, officially United Nations requested to visit the sites, infected site was on Saturday, mm-hmm. officially. And they got the okay on Sunday. And they visited the infected area on Monday. So there was no delay. That's one thing. And you're talking about what we're going to do about the evil thing if something
right.
happened.
Yeah, so, yeah, because we got a short segment of this, so just answer that.
Sorry?
Yeah, no, because we're running out of time, so just answer that quickly, Gigi. What can we do?
What can we do? We need to be righteous ourselves before we advocate righteousness. United States participated in the chemical weapon with Iraq and killing the Kurds. We're doing a drone. We're killing one bad guy against 15 guys.
All right, so I got you. We're doing what they do. So I appreciate the call. Let me ask other people because I want to get as many opinions as possible. Let's go next to Victoria, British Columbia, and this individual wants to comment on Syria. You're live on the air.
Yeah, that previous caller is absolutely right. So were Don and Laura. I'm Jewish. Israel has a nuclear bomb. Syria has agreed to join the convention, the United Nations Convention on the Abolition of both Nuclear Weapons and Chemical Weapons.
Right.
Israel refuses to sign this document, standing for decades at the United Nations. Mm-hmm. Brigadier General Hugh Hester said that the real enemies of man are poverty, ignorance, and bigotry. Wars and preparations for wars increase these enemies.
Right.
The fact remains, General Hester said that successive Washington administrations have pursued a global grab for power policy since World War II under the euphemistic term of communist containment. That term has been used as a fig leaf to cover their real purpose, which is world domination by the United States. And in pursuit of that objective, General Hester concluded, they have brought this nation perilously close to a fascist state, the one thing we allegedly fought World War II to avoid. So let's do our homework here at home.
Sure, I got you.
Disarmament.
Okay, let me get one last caller in here, and then we'll just go to Tom from Boulder, Colorado. Tom, you're going to get the last word. You've got about 30 seconds.
Howdy. Negotiations. We need to open peace negotiations right off the bat, and the last caller is quite right on innocence. We used nerve gas, and
right.
We encouraged the Iranians.
Gotcha. All right, well, listen, we're going to have to go here. I appreciate it. Look, I'm all for peace. I'd love to see peace negotiations. If that's the route we need to do, then let's get it going. So, listen, as always, thanks to Jim Javinsky, Shane, Sean Taylor, and, of course, Tom Hartman. Don't forget to check out Tom's book. It is available at TomHartman.com. And, look, I would say dream. Dream as though you'll live forever and live as though you could die today. So thanks so much for the opportunity. And as we always say, democracy is a participatory sport, so tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.